Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
A 1, 2, 3, 4.
Thanks for listening to this podcast produced by Diddy TV. Visit DiddyTV.com for more exclusive on-demand content or download the official Diddy TV app from your app store today. Welcome to Insights, everyone. Today, Amy Wright talks with Andrew Ferris, co-founder and primary songwriter for NXS, a band that sold over 50 million records worldwide. In 2016, Andrew Ferris was inducted into the Australian Songwriter Hall of Fame for his contributions to the music industry. He's been performing and writing for more than 40 years. He likes to split his time between Australia and Nashville, where you can find him performing in famous spots like the Bluebird Cafe. He's here today to chat with Amy Wright about his recently released self-titled debut album, which is steadily climbing the charts, and to discuss his dynamic career and life in music. So without further ado, from Diddy TV, this is Insights with Amy Wright and Andrew Ferris.
Welcome, Andrew, first of all, to Diddy TV. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Amy.
I can't wait for everyone to hear the whole new album, which is titled Andrew Ferris. So you grew up, you're in Nashville right now, but you grew up and you live most of your time in Australia?
Yeah, I grew up in the most remote geographical city in the world, which is Perth in Western Australia. And I lived there till I was 12. The only thing of great musical significance in between is I learned to play piano when I was 9. And then I also took a trip to London by ship because my father had met my mother, who was Australian, and my dad was originally from London in England. And he had come out at the end of World War II. He hadn't been back to see his parents or my grandparents. So he put us boys, my brothers and I, on a ship, and we went to London. And in those years, you know, you didn't fly anywhere. You usually went by ship, or you're in the military, you might have flown somewhere, I guess, or you were very, very wealthy. Most people didn't fly everywhere. And so we went by ship. And when I got there, you know, it wasn't a time when a lot of people, would travel a lot. So other Australians heard that we were there. And we got invited to go to a variety television show, my brothers and I, my dad and mom. And out walked the Beatles, they played. And we saw them. That was the first band I saw with my brothers. And we were in a little television studio, and they're right in front of us. They put us right down the front because we were kids, you know. And later on, my elder brother, Tim, who was in NXS, and my younger brother, John, as well, obviously as Michael and Gary and Kirk, as members of later on with NXS. But as brothers, Tim and I went to Dad and we said, was that true? Did we actually, like, we saw the Beatles, I remember that, but did we, what happened, like, what else happened? He goes, well, afterwards you went and talked to him. I'm like, we did what? He says, yeah, you went over and you talked to him. And we're like, oh, wow, okay. And then I thought back on it and I thought, well, actually that makes sense because we were little, just young kids. And it's nice, actually, when you're out performing and you're feeling overwhelmed and there's a lot of adults running around, you know, when you're doing live performance stuff. And children are so much simpler because they just want the simplicity of things, you know. So they were probably happy talking to us guys, you know. I think later on my younger brother, John, John Ferris, I think he'd met up with George Harrison or something somewhere along the line, but I don't remember meeting any of those other Beatles. No,
Do you attribute that experience for your love of music or kind of getting you started?
Yeah, that's where I was kind of heading. Sorry, I've been a bit verbose there. Is that, yeah, I mean, I think seeing the Beatles, that when we went back to Australia, you know, we started pretending we were in a band and had tennis rackets or whatever, you know, and then started fooling around on instruments. My younger brother learned to play drums and my older brother learned to play guitar classically, you know. And I used to sneak into his bedroom when he wasn't looking and pick up his guitar. So I taught myself to play the guitar. I was never trained to play guitar. And then later on, we didn't play together for a long time. The last thing we wanted to do was to be near each other as brothers.
of course. We wanted
to play. Yeah, right. Because we were, especially as teenagers. And then so I started forming my own band with other people. And I met Michael Hutchins in a school yard where I was. It's a really complicated story. Basically, I was in a high school I wasn't supposed to be in because the government hadn't finished building this other high school. So they put us kids in this other high school. Nobody wanted us there. The parents didn't want us there. We were just an embarrassment and the government didn't know what to do with us. And amongst all that, in walks Michael, who had grown up, well, he was born in Australia, but he'd grown up in Hong Kong. And so when he came into the schoolyard, I knew that he was going to get picked on because I understood the politics of where we were and the situation we were already in as little kids. You know, young, very young teenagers. And I was pretty good at sports when I was younger, you know, certain sports. And so a bigger friend of mine and me went over and basically these other guys were hassling him. And he said, no, you're going to leave him alone. And we pulled it off. We pulled it off and they walked away, you know. And so he came, he said, who are you guys? And we said, well, we're sitting over here. Come sit with us. So he came over and that's how I met him. And then later on, we never talked about music. We talked about motorbikes and we talked about girls, talked about lots of stuff, you know, but we didn't talk about music. That came later. I didn't see him for a long time. He went to Los Angeles. He got, his mother had a job there working in Hollywood. And Michael went to North Hollywood High School for quite a while. And then when he came back to Australia, he changed a lot. His hair had grown a lot and he had all this other thing he was bringing with him. And I realized it when I started talking to him. This isn't like some of the other guys I'm going to school with. He's changed, you know. And then we started talking about music then. He used to write a lot of lyrics. He wasn't a singer. He used to mainly write poetry, you know, and prose and stuff. Whereas most of the guys at my age at that point wanted to talk about football or girls or beer or whatever they want, you know. They want to talk about poetry, you know. And I suddenly realized, well, he's different. He's still different, you know. And then that's how we got on. And we started, I eventually said, why don't we start writing songs together? And so that led, cut a long story short, is my brothers then got involved because they liked my band that I had with Michael and Gary, the bass player. So Gary, Michael, and myself were already in a band. Then my brothers, Tim and John, and Kirk, Tim's best friend, came along. That's how the band started. That's how INXS started, yeah.
What did you first call yourself? Because it wasn't INXS, it was another name,
no,
right?
No, we were called the Farris Brothers. My name's Andrew Farris, I'm the middle one. My older brother's name's Tim. My younger brother's name's John. We have a sister as well, Allison. And I did try to teach her the bass, but she said, no, I don't want to do that.
You needed a fan.
Yeah, well, it could have been like, you know, yeah, the sound of music or something, you know, right, you know. But there's been some very talented family bands, you know, and ironically too, you know, with the Farris Brothers in INXS is like AC/DC with Malcolm and Angus Young and the Bee Gees too. A lot of people don't realize the Bee Gees spent a lot of time in Australia, you know, as well when they were younger, yeah.
So who came up with the name INXS then?
That's a good question. Actually, I think it was, we were playing a show somewhere north of Sydney along the coast. And I think it was someone from the road crew walked up to us and said, INXS. And we're like, yeah, we didn't sort of get it quite then. And they're like, no, the four letters, you know, and we're like, That is absolutely genius, right? So right there. And of course, Michael loved it because he didn't, you know, we were the Farris brothers and there was a little bit too much of that. You know, he wanted to be, you know, that guy, you know, which I can understand. It's definitely a lead singer thing. You've got to have that to be a great lead singer, you know. And so we embraced the name and we loved it and off we went. Yeah.
So when did you get your first signing to a label? When was that?
Oh, that's a good question. That would have been around about late 79, early 1980. And that was kind of all really bizarre, that part. I don't think any of us really understood the recording nature of what we were doing as a band until about the third album that we released, the Shabu Shabar. Up to that point, all of our studio recordings were like a soundtrack to our live gigs. Most of the songs we were playing were designed to play live in pubs, you know, in bawdy, you know, kind of drinking holes where people were smoking and they get in fist fights and everyone's drinking, and it was pretty crazy stuff. It's like where AC/DC came out of and a lot of other pub bands. And so we designed our music around that atmosphere rather than designing it around recording, you know. And it wasn't till later we began to realize, especially when we started to travel overseas. No. We got to do it the other way around. We have to start recording for recording's sake, not for, you know, as a support for the live show, you know.
Were you mostly playing in Australia at that time? Or?
Yeah. Well, we couldn't afford to eat even, you know. But we were lucky in one way. We used to play nine gigs a week. We'd play 7 days a week. We'd play two shows on a Saturday and then two shows on a Sunday. And we just played music all the time everywhere, but we had no money. It was terrible. And I remember one day our manager at the time, who's sadly passed away since, he used to say to us, oh, if you're starving, you can always buy a bag of oranges. So we used to give him a lot of stick about that later on, you know.
So when did you actually get your first break outside of Australia? Was that with Shabu Shabu or was it later?
With Shabu Shabar, that's how you
Shabu
pronounce
Shabar.
That. Yeah,
sorry.
My brother came up with that name for the album, Tim, yeah. I still don't know what it means, but anyway. We really had a fortunate experience with Shabu Shabar because the record producer, Mark Opitz, had worked with AC/DC and a lot of other, back then, very, very important bands like Cold Chisel, and the Divinyls, some really, really great people, very, very clever people. And we started recording with him, and those recordings we started to make began to realize that we could really design a sound that was very different than anything that we had heard or knew of. And we stopped trying to copy other people, if you know what I mean, and started just to embrace the animal that we were as a group of people. We stopped trying to sound like them. We want to sound like them. And, you know, we stopped all that and just started sound like us, you know.
So what was your first big break outside? What album was it?
Well, okay, yeah, Shabu Shabar. And then we had a single called The One Thing. And and we came out at the same time as MTV started. So our band was one of those bands that were fortunate enough to have lots of videos. And because of the tyranny of distance between Australia and the United States, or the world, really, with Australia, you know, it's very, very geographically remote from other countries, apart from Asia and New Zealand. But, you know, we started making all these videos very early on in our career. And fortunately, when MTV started, they said, do you have any videos? And we were like, yeah, we got heaps of them. Do you want them? They're like, sure. And so they couldn't get enough of them. So we kept giving them all these videos we'd made. And then we had made videos for The One Thing and for Don't Change. And if you talk about, you know, career breaks right there, that song Don't Change, like, for example, Bruce Springsteen, who I'm a huge fan of, he covered that song when he came down to Australia to perform live a while back. And that's when you begin to sort of realize that we were beginning to connect with people. You know, you sort of think at first, oh, do we matter? What happened then? What was all that about? You know, and the next minute you see other people reacting or covering songs or, you know, and then we started performing in bigger and bigger and bigger venues, you know. slowly but surely, and then that happened internationally, and we ended up working in over 50 countries.
What do you think MTV did for NXS? Because it really broke so many bands, because it was the first time there was that visual associated with a song. Before that, that wasn't a thing, really.
No, that's right. Actually, that's true. And also, one of our videos, we had a song. We shot many videos, but one of them was a song called What You Need. And I remember Mick Jagger, who used to come along to our shows when we were much younger. He came and saw us at the Royal Albert Hall in London in one of the first shows we did in London around about 83 or 84 or something. And then, so he and Michael Hutchins knew each other. And then we shot this video called What You Need. And back then, there wasn't the computer technology, or at least outside of Hollywood, I guess, that was available to the consumer to make the kind of visual products you can make today. And so we wanted to make a really different video for the song What You Need. And so we shot this film, if you like, but with a motor drive camera, and then had the each individual negative on the film hand-colored. So it was almost like a running, it was real, but it had been animated at the same time. And Mick Jagger called Michael and said, how did you do that? You know, where did you find the technology? And we said, oh, we took the film down to the local chemist and it cost us $50, you know?
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And, but I think that was what a lot of that era was like. I think it was quite an exciting era because you really had to push boundaries to discover things, to try things, with the videos. And, we shot three videos, for example, in Czechoslovakia, in the beautiful city in Prague, when it was still, communist. And we were followed around all the time by the government people because we were in a communist country shooting videos, you know. And the video producer, Ian Brown, I think his name was, big Scottish fella, and he could see these two guys in trench coats with the pork pie hats on the other side of the bridge in Prague, and they were just pretending to read newspapers, you know, while we were shooting these videos. So he walks over the bridge and he goes, you don't need to stand there pretending that you're not watching us. You need to come over here and have some Stolichnaya with us. So they, sure enough, they walk over the bridge and he puts down some shot glasses and they have a shot of vodka each. And they seemed happy afterwards, but they went everywhere with us, you know. And we could go anywhere we wanted in the city. But that was one thing too. I remember shooting those videos. It wasn't so much the shooting of the videos and it wasn't even so much trying to come up with something technologically interesting. We began to realize the cultural part of it was just as interesting. So that's why we went to Czechoslovakia. We also went to Japan and shot videos. We shot videos out on a wharf with a Japanese biker gang on one video for Original Sin. And then we went and also shot another video at the oldest temple, Buddhist temple in Tokyo. And they'd never ever had Westerners in that temple ever shoot a video ever. And the head monk, the Japanese head monk, came over to Michael and he was talking to us. And he said, it's so nice that you're here. And we said, well, we are overwhelmed because we had heard that for 850 years, you've never had, you know, foreigners or gaijin or whatever come in to the temple here and do anything except, you know, pay respect for what the temple is. And we said, why us, these young guys from Australia, why are you letting us shoot this video in this ancient temple? And he goes, well, that's because I like to play the trumpet. And he goes down, he picks up the trumpet. He goes, da-da-da-da-da-da, this trumpet, right? And we're going, that's the reason? After 850 years? You know? But I thought that was a very Buddhist thing right there. You know, like it's very, you know, very
that
human.
That is hilarious.
Oh, it's a true story. But when you talk about these videos, to me it wasn't so much about the videos. I found the whole thing just fascinating. The construction of the videos, how it all came together, the different people we work with. you know, the different video directors and the things that they all did or didn't do and how they did them, you know, it was all pretty interesting, you know. Yeah.
Well, it's amazing what video does for songs and for artists, because it's that real connection between a fan and the artist that you can imagine, but when you see it in video form, it's just a different, it sticks in your head. I think that was the beauty of MTV. You know, all those videos just, you know, they stick in your head and you go back and you watch them now and they're still there. You still remember them.
That's true. And in fact, my wife, Marley, and I, the other night, we watched an 80s rerun of videos. And some of them I recognized, and a lot of the music behind the videos was pretty cool too. But what struck me from watching those videos, and I found really interesting, or struck us both actually, was how what was banned back in the 80s is like, you know, compared to what, you know, what you can access on a flat screen now, you know, it was so almost cute, the reasons why they were banning things back then, you know.
So what was it like to go from being a kid in Australia to being globally famous?
Well, yeah, I never really thought of it quite like that until one day I went back home from one of the tours. We used to do these long tours. You know, we'd go away for 3 or 6 months. We'd live on tour buses, roll around in different countries or whatever. One day I got back to my home in the suburbs when I still lived in the suburbs. I don't live in the suburbs or the city anymore. I live kind of in the middle of nowhere. But back then, I'd come home and there was a retired Portuguese army sergeant who owned the house next door to me. And he'd been mowing his lawn and I was out doing whatever I was doing. And I said, "Do you want to have a beer?" He said, "Sure." And he used to like drying fish in this shed out the back and he salted them, right? And I'm sitting there, I'm talking to him and I'm saying, you know, I go, "How's your day been?" Joe, that was his name. "How's your day?" He's, "Yeah, day's been good. Yeah, yeah." And he says, "What have you been doing?" I said, "Oh, well, we were rolling around in a bus, me and these other guys, and we played to 10,000 people a night." And he sort of looks at me for a minute and he goes, "Okay." So I think the thing I'm trying to say is the reality of what you actually do when you're a performer and the music connection part of it, it's the connection with people who don't know you. If you're a part of a community, let's say, and you just go down and you play at the local pub, or you play at the local theatre, and all your neighbours and all your friends know who you are, and that's what you do, and you go play there, you're not really famous. You're just that guy that goes down to the theatre or goes down, right, and plays at the little bar. But the moment you're involved in anything to do with broad media and you're getting broadcast out everywhere, everyone's paying attention to what you're doing and saying and what you look like and, you know, all the rest of it, you know. That's how it works, you know.
Well, because your songs were famous in so many countries and listened to and charted in so many countries, do you find it different, or how do you find it when a song is charting at number one in this country, number 30 in another country, or do you find it to be a big mystery? Or
I think that's a really good question. I think where I have realized how fortunate I am as a songwriter is to have worked with a group like INXS, my brothers, Tim and John, and Michael, Kirk and Gary. We really did whatever it took. I don't ever remember any one of us saying, "I can't do that," or "We're not going to go here," or "I'm not going to do that," or, you know, we just did whatever we needed to do. And I have a huge respect for those guys because I know what they did because I was there with them. But I think for me now, what I'm doing, I take my lessons that I've learned from all of those years, and I love playing like with the people who are patiently sitting behind me, Travis and Victoria and many other musicians who I know. I feel really lucky because I'm performing with some very, very clever, talented people who share the same vision as me, which is they like playing live music. You know, we like playing live music, and I particularly like, as a songwriter, the country, rock, Americana, flavored music. I find that's quite an exciting movement at the moment. People are looking for something, you know, different. I like also, because I come from a country rural area where my family and I live, people wear cowboy hats and they have animals, and it's all natural. It's not a Hollywood film. That's the way it is. That's where it rolls, you know. And that's where we live. I've owned my place for 30 years, and I've been through droughts. I've watched what happens in communities when they're suffering because of drought, and people go through a lot of hardship, or they can't own their farm anymore because they can't make enough money because it won't rain, or these things happen. And yet most of us just assume that, you know, food comes from a supermarket, you know.
What was the impetus behind this new solo album? What were you experiencing that made you think, I want to put out an Americana-style album? And I have to say, right, I listened to it, and it's Americana, but it also has rock in there, so there's a little bit of both.
Yeah, I'm a fan of quite a few different genres of music, obviously including country, mm-hmm, and, mm-hmm, and Western and Americana and folk, but many other, you know, forms of music that I've worked with over the years, including electronic music, you know. Believe it or not, I worked a lot with synthesizers and computer technologies and whatever. But I'm finding it more and more interesting in this era to not rely on that technology and just to rely on the skills, the human skill sets that people have. I think they are skill sets that are very, very important. And I really, really hope that the future generations keep that in mind as they go along. I think there's something very human and necessary musically in the communication of music to keep it real, you know. I mean, technology does amazing things. I mean, I think it's incredible, you know, in this era that young people may not necessarily know how to play an instrument, but they can construct all this music, you know, and I think that's really exciting for them. But at the same time, I feel just like historically where country music, for example, started, or folk music, and the combination of all these musics, you know, I like to think that that's how my album kind of came together. As a songwriter, I started thinking more and more about where did all this start in the first place? And if you've got to think of an era before electricity, and it's not easy because, you know, I've lived a little bit without electricity on the farm when we've had blackouts or whatever, but I think, you know, I'm really fortunate because I collect my rainwater off a roof, you know, and God enables it to rain and you can drink water, you know, or you can go over there and you can grow that in the ground and then you can eat it, you know. You don't need electricity to do that. It just happens anyway, you know. But everything that we're dealing with right now and everything we're going through at the moment is we're in this huge transition where electricity has taken us to somewhere. I still don't see a guide manual anywhere of where this is all heading. That's all. I wish someone could explain it to me exactly. But I know that we're all doing it together. We're all in it together, right? I'll add this as well. I just want to say that how I got started with making my own album was that I've always been a songwriter. So I had lots of songs that I'd recorded in very rough demo form, you know, either with myself singing or perhaps if I was co-writing with someone else, they were singing. And I had all these songs and I was like, what am I supposed to do with all this, you know? I like some of them are okay, that one I'm not so crazy about. What will I do with all this? And then I realized, particularly when I got to Nashville, the group of people, the collection of people, or the community is a better word, of people, like-minded people who are very, very good at performance, you know, playing their instruments, very talented people. I thought, well, I'll get some people together and we'll just track some of my demos, you know. But running parallel to that was my interest in Australian, like old bush rangers, outlaws, and then also I'm a bit of a romantic when it comes to the old West in America, but both have a parallel history that's similar. And so when I started tracking my demos, and you know, I began to realize I could make an album if I steer it in a certain direction where I'm actually connecting how I feel about where we've arrived at with everything. That's why I tried to think, what would it have been like before electricity when I was writing a lot of the lyrics? You know, I'm thinking, well, you know, how would people have thought, you know? And one of the things that began to occur to me was, if you really wanted to, you know, romantically, in one sense, you get on a ship and you just go somewhere else, or you'd get on a horse and ride off into the sunset, literally, you know, right? And it's hard to imagine that now because everything's so, you know, mechanized, if you like, you know. And so I began to steer my lyrics more towards writing that kind of thing, you know.
It's hard to imagine in the world we live in surviving without electricity or all these things that mm-hmm. we have. We're very out of touch with the earth, so to speak. And, you know, I think that when you do get in touch with it, when you leave the city, and I think it's very inspiring. And I was listening to some of the songs, and it seemed like there was a real connection to the American West in the music.
Yeah, well, that started really a fire in me when I'd been songwriting in Nashville, you know, doing co-writes and the way that they do it in this town, and they do it really well, like really well. But I took a horse riding adventure trip with my wife Marlena down along the Mexican border, and we met a gentleman by the name of Craig Lawson, who's passed away since. And that's why I dedicate my album to him and his wife Tam, because Craig and Tam, he was a wrangler and he owned a cattle ranch down there. And like I own a farm, and we went out horse riding, and he just gave us an education on horseback about that old West area. And we were literally riding through canyons where you could still see stagecoach tracks in the ground. I'm not talking about modern vehicles or rubber tires. I'm talking about, and I'm like, how did you know this was here? He said, because I ride all through this country and I know where it is, all this, you know, wilderness area. And I was riding around looking at old silver mines and all this stuff, and I'm looking around, I'm going, this is not a Hollywood movie. This is real. These people actually did all these things. And up the road is Turnstone, you know, and over there is Mexico, right? And there would have been pioneers, there would have been settlers, there would have been no electricity. You had outlaws, you had the settlers, you had all the First Nations people. And the parallels with Australia in early history are very similar. And that's what I'm saying. I more and more began to realize, I know what I need to do now. I understand what kind of album I want to make. I'm not just being, you know, retro. I got inspired. I felt emotionally, I know how to do this now. I know what I'm doing, you know, artistically. Mm.
So where was the album recorded?
Some of it in Nashville and some of it in Australia. Some of it, I have a home farm studio. It's a humble studio, but it sounds good. And it's the only recording studio I've ever been in that has an open fireplace in it. You can put a log in the fire if you want. And I like the relaxed feeling of that, but I wanted the immediacy of the recordings. Like a lot of the recordings that are on my album, I didn't track layer them, you know, like I'll start with this track and I'll add that track and then we'll add this track and I'll do that. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to have an immediacy to the album, where a lot of it was tracked very quickly. The song My Cajun Girl that's on the album was tracked in one take. Just one take.
Do you think that's more in line with how people used to record, so you get a different sound?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And what happens is that I think there's something magical happens. Or perhaps magic, I don't like that word that much. I think it, something human happens where you're working off each other in real time, you know, as people. And someone goes, oh, I can hear what he or she's playing. And then they work off that. And then that's how the recording really has some really, you know, really interesting definition to it sometimes, you know. And I can hear it on a lot of the older recordings of very, you know, from old school people, you know, back in the jazz era and whatever, and country, early country music too. But I'm fortunate really to be able to talk about any of this. And I also am grateful for the people who helped me perform on my recordings, and some of the people who co-wrote with me as well, particularly writers such as James Dean Hicks and Buck Johnson, Kieran Gribben, Marty Fredrickson. But I'm also pleased with the songs I wrote by myself, and I'm learning to have more confidence in that. So, yeah.
Well, you've also written some songs for other people, I know. And do you like writing for other folks as well as yourself?
Yes, I do. And one of the things I've also really enjoyed is working with people from different nationalities and different, you know, backgrounds. I've worked a lot with other people, and in different countries too. Especially in the years when I was working with NXS, you know, we would record in Italy or France or London or wherever we were. Spain, I've recorded in Spain, Japan, India. And all of those cultural experiences are really important too to me. That I like to bring everything that I can into my recording process. You know, like experiences and things that people have met, things I've learnt from watching some very, very clever people, you know, with me and around me, and engineers, record producers, that sort of thing. You know, yeah.
Would you say this collection of songs is one that people can sing around the campfire, back to what you were talking about, which is people playing instruments and actually singing and without maybe all the electronics?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think there's quite a few songs, actually. I think probably Come Midnight would be one. I'd say Apache Pass, which was one of the first songs that I wrote on the album that really began to define what my album was going to be, from those experiences of those, I don't know how to put it, but trying to do research or exploring in the areas where people did things in a different era. I look for it at home too in Australia. I like going out to remote places and just looking around and not, you know, not just looking at a monument or something, you know, but actually just going to places that are remote, you know. They're really interesting. Mm.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed the entire album, and it's now a part of my playlist. Will you be touring for the album? Or
yeah, you know, I'd love to do that. I've already started playing. I've got a great posse of musicians with me, and we're headed to play Song of the Mountains in Virginia, at Marion there, in a famous, beautiful old theater. And then we do the same thing. That's on the 6th of August. And then we go and play on the 22nd of August at Woodsongs, which is Michael Jonathan's folk kind of setup that he's got there. I think it's beautiful old Lincoln Theater, I think it is. And then a very famous place as well, but very much, that is very much old country, roots areas. You know, that's in Lexington, Kentucky. Bluegrass, particularly folk and country style shows that I'll be doing at first. Yeah, that's where I want to start off. Yeah, playing that.
Well,
kind
selfishly
of thing.
Speaking, we want to get you down to Memphis, so we're going to have to make that happen at some point.
Yeah, we'll go electric at some point. Yeah.
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 Exactly. Well, Andrew, it was just a pleasure having you on Diddy TV. Andrew Ferris, the new album, it's out. It's your solo album, and I encourage everyone to get a copy of it. And we wish you the best in your next endeavor and also on your tour.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having us.
1, 2, 3. I heard a roaring just like thunder, like a waterfall. I climbed a mountain through a forest, and I have felt it all and heard the final call.
Oh, say I, don't cry. Tears in the rain. Oh, say I, don't cry. Tears in the rain. Tears in the rain.
We took a journey down a river through a jungle. We saw the ruins of the progress, the destruction of proud and ancient world.
Oh, say I. Don't cry, tears in the rain. Oh, say I, don't cry. Seasons will change, tears in the rain.
Or
do we want to know? Or do we walk away? What's gonna make a change? What do we have to say? Hey, oh, hey, say I, don't cry. Tears in the rain. Oh, say I, don't cry. Seasons will change. Oh, say I, don't cry. Tears in the rain. Tears in the rain.
This is a latest single I got out called You Are My Rock, and we're going to play the whole thing, I guess. Okay, Brian, okay. Here we go. 1, 2, 3, 1. Well, thank you. Well, thank you for being here with me. Thank you for being in my dream. For days you fill with happiness, filling up my emptiness. Wanna thank you for showing me some peace.
You are my rock,
my everything.
You are my rock,
my own.
My everything.
There are no storms or hurricanes across several oceans and drowning rain. You won't be changed.
Won't be
Well, I see people out in the street.
Out in the street.
They're just trying to make ends meet. My neighbors and their families with responsibilities, building all their dreams upon a rock. You're always wild and you won't be changed. You're like a fire never to be tamed. You're standing tall in the driving rain. You are my rock. Everything. You are my rock, my only one, my everything. Where is this leading to? I dedicate my song to you. Another fool without a clue who needs a rock. You are my rock. Well, thank you for being a crazy friend. You're crazy at the start, but not the end. Well, I raise my glass and toast your health. For being strong when I needed help. For being real when everyone pretends. You are my rock.
You are my rock, you are my rock.
My everything.
My everything.
You are my rock.
You are my rock, you are my
only one. My everything.
My everything.
There are no storms on hurricanes, cross seven oceans and burning plains, and I know you just won't be tamed. Mm. You are my rock.
That's it for this hour, folks. Keep up with Andrew Ferris by visiting his website and social media pages, and be sure to listen to his self-titled debut album and tell a friend or two about it while you're at it. Touring is still important to him, so look for Andrew on the road when he visits a city near you. From all of us at Diddy TV, thanks again for tuning in today, and we hope to see you again real soon, right here on Insights.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.